I usually take 30 lectures to teach global seismology, and it's kind of hard to do it in this amount of time. So there's a web page here, which is my class and script. I don't know if you can read that, mahi.ucsd.edu, capital G, guy, SIO 227B. And once we actually have wireless in here, so. This is not for the faint of heart. It's fairly mathematical. But if you really want to know what's going on, then this is how you do it. You basically start with the background, and it turns out that most of global seismology, the theory is based on free oscillation theory. That includes the interpretation of body waves and so on, mostly. So you have to learn all this stuff. And then once you've got all this stuff, then you can actually do surface waves and body waves right at the end. So we're kind of doing this backwards here, but never mind. And then you actually make an Earth model. So if you really want to know what's going on, then you're welcome to download all that stuff. It's not quite complete, but it's getting there. The other stuff on here, these body wave notes of this one, there's some mode notes for Monday, which is actually a paper which has all the background in. And then there's a global inversion paper, which is a couple years old now, but it gives the background, and I'll be using that as background for next Friday. And actually, this resolution paper might be interesting for the discussion on modes on Monday. Okay, so that is there, out there, and you're welcome to take the stuff off it. All right, now, can you put something in front of the, I don't want to turn it off because I need the computer later on. Okay. Actually, I also recommended a JGR paper, which I thought would be on the JGR webpage, but it is the only paper on JGR that I can find where the PDF is temporarily unavailable.
Oh, I found another one.
And it actually has been for the last 2 years, so I'm not sure what temporary means here. So I have some preprints of that if you're interested. Okay, so what we're going to do today is to, well, what I'm going to try and do is to give you a feel for what we can tell about the Earth from body waves from the point of view of seismic tomography. So today I'm just going to give you, hopefully give you a feel for what the data are like and how they sample the Earth and what some of the problems are with the data, the issues that you have to worry about before you do the inversion. And then we'll be doing talking about inverting the data next Friday for getting structure. Typically, we use data from global seismic networks. The coverage is reasonably complete. About every island that could possibly have a station on has a station on. Some of them have stations on that shouldn't have stations on. Never mind. A lot of these are little coral atolls where the mean elevation is about 2 feet. And you drill a hole into the coral basement there and hope to God it doesn't fill with water. It's a mess. But anyway, we need the coverage, and you'll see that we still don't have the coverage in the southern hemisphere. You can see these big holes down here. That's going to be a problem. Okay, now the kind of data that we get off these are three-component seismograms. You've seen these now, and I think everybody will be familiar with the first 5 minutes of this talk, so you can wake up slowly. Anyway, so these guys are nice, sharp, impulsive arrivals, and these are the guys that shoot through the Earth. We give them different names because they're taking different paths, and we'll play with that in a minute. And these are the two horizontal components and the vertical component. And as Adam said, these we normally rotate these so that we have a component in a direction towards the source and a component perpendicular to that. And the reason we do that is that the transverse component only has SH wave motion on it. It doesn't have any of the P or the SV, which is only polarized in this direction, at least in a spherical Earth, that's true, and a non-anisotropic Earth, that's true. But occasionally you can see on the transverse you get some junk out here, which shouldn't be there, right, in a spherical Earth. but there is something there, probably conceivably because of anisotropy, but probably because the instrument responses aren't very good, which is an equally likely likely occurrence. So it's the arrival times of these things that I'm going to talk about. You can do waveform modeling, but what I'm going to talk about today are the arrival times. And there's an issue about what you mean by an arrival time of a pulse like this. It's less and less clear as you go to longer and longer periods, so we'll talk about that a little bit too. Okay, so all right, so I'll just show this for completeness. You've seen this before. We have two kinds of waves, P waves and S waves, and these are the two kinds of radio waves, the Love waves and the radio waves, but we're not going to talk about those today. All right. Now, so the idea is that you have a source, and the wavefront comes out of the source and spreads, and this will be either a P or an S wave. And what rays are perpendiculars to the wavefront, okay? All right, so everybody knows this. Now, if the Earth were uniform, the wavefronts would just remain spherical, all right? But because we have velocity increasing with depth, then my waveform will start off spherical, but it's going to get a bulge down here because this part of the wavefront is traveling faster than the rest, right? Because it's seeing the faster velocities deep inside the Earth. So if you plot a perpendicular to this wavefront, it's going to bend, all right? And it's going to bend according to a very simple law, which you all know, which is Snell's law, right? And that's the only physics I'm going to talk about today is Snell's law, all right? We can do all of ray theory with Snell's law. So you can forget the wave equation, you can forget potentials and solenoidal stuff and all that nonsense. We don't have to do it. All right. Okay, so we have, we measure these travel times and we make a travel time curve, and it doesn't look like this because we can't actually observe all of these things. I'll tell you what you can and you can't observe. And to read this plot, you probably all know this, you would stand, say, at a distance of 80 degrees, and after a certain time the P wave would hit you, then you'd see something called PP, and then you'd see something called quadruple P, and then PS, and so on, later and later. Okay? So let's just play a little game with these and see what these different, this whole zoo up here actually looks like on the computer. So my computer, of course, has fallen asleep. Now I need my glasses. Don't turn that thing off, whatever you do. Okay. You can be able to play with this later on. Meredith, I have to go ride my horse, so sorry about that. But Meredith is going, and Christine are going to do a tutorial this afternoon on getting some seismic data from the RSDMC and actually making some picks. And if you make on the order of 100,000 picks, you'll be able to build your own 3D model later on. But you're also going to play with this little program. You just find okay. So this is something to compute travel times, and it will plot the ray paths, which is kind of nice. So if you run it on the run path N, you give it a standard seismic name, and then you tell it ray name like S, and you tell it how many rays you want to compute, and you pray. And you get a little plot that looks like this. So this is the mantle, this is the outer core, this is the inner core, and here is S, that 20 rays turning throughout the Earth. And the program is kind of a little bit paranoid about the upper mantle for a variety of reasons. And so it likes rays to turn in the lower mantle. So the first ray that's actually here is turning in the lower mantle. Okay, and you get a little, let's do something else. That's not very interesting, is it? Let's do run path N S, whatever. Okay, so this is SS. So SS is the thing that bounces off the underside of the Earth, and you have two S legs. And any leg in the mantle that's a shear leg gets the letter S. If it's a P leg, it gets the letter P. Now you only have P legs in the outer core, that gets the letter K. And you can have either P or S in the inner core, which gets the symbols I or J. And we can argue about whether or not J has ever been seen. On the second leg of this SS ray path, you can see that the rays actually turn over on themselves. If you were to plot two rays together, you'd see that on the second leg, they would fold over like this. And this thing here is called an internal caustic. And that actually causes a pi by 4 phase shift, at least asymptotically, in the waveform. And so you get a distortion of the SS waveform relative to the S waveform, which is essentially a Hilbert transform. Okay, and if you want to measure SS relative to S, you had better remember that you have to Hilbert transform the S to make it look like the SS. Okay, and it's all because of this little guy here. All right, so this little guy here, I have to remember not to point at the screen. Huh? Okay, run path. So if you do a triple S, 30. Okay, then you actually have two internal caustics. The next leg has another internal caustic. So now you get a 90-degree phase shift, and that's just a flip in sign. All right, so triple S is just flipped relative to S. Okay, and so that you have to remember too. You can do the same with P. They look the same, except when P hits the surface, it also gets a flip in sign too. SH doesn't, because it's traveling parallel to the surface like this, and you don't get a flip when you hit the free surface. Now the core phases are kind of fun. This should remind you. Do you remember the spirograph, the toy that you used to get for Christmas? I'll tell you about this. You get this little table of stuff. This comes in a little that's actually computed as you go along, and this tells you the distance, the time, which you can plot. I'll do that in a minute. T star. That is the integrated attenuation along the ray. Okay. If you think of a travel time as introducing a phase shift, e to the I omega t in the seismogram, if you make t be complex, so it has an imaginary part, then you're going to get an e to the minus omega t star out of that, where t star is the imaginary part of the travel time. So t star is used to mimic attenuation inside the Earth. I'll talk about that a little bit more later on. dx by dp is kind of interesting. P is the ray parameter. Now, ray parameter is key to everything in ray theory. We'll go through that in some detail. This is the bobbing radius, so you can see that we go right from the core mantle boundary all the way up to the 660, because this thing doesn't like to talk to the upper mantle. dx by dp is used in amplitude calculations, and it tells you how many rays will arrive in a certain distance range. So if dx by dp is zero, right, it means that if you change the ray parameter, which is governing which rays come and see you, you know, every time I run this program and you see a ray go out like that, there's a constant ray parameter along that ray, and we'll come that. And if dx by dp is zero, it means that if I change p a bit so I can have several rays, x doesn't change. So a whole bunch of rays arrive at the same time, and I get a large amplitude there. It's called a caustic. All right. If dx by dp gets big, then it means that I don't have very many rays over a certain distance range, and the amplitudes will be small. Okay, so this will tell you something about the expected amplitudes of arrivals. Okay, there's one run path underscore p. This program will suggest ray parameter ranges, which it feels comfortable with. You can override those if you like and make it do things that the program doesn't really want to do. Whoops. What's it called? It's called run path underscore p. See, I haven't got my glasses on, that's why. Did I get it right that time? Yeah. All right, so. Okay, now this one I made it actually work in the upper mantle. And if we blow this thing up a little and take a look, there it is. Okay, this is why we don't like to fool around with the upper mantle very much, because when you start ray tracing through the upper mantle, you get these sharp increases in velocity at the 410 and the 660, and they refract the waves back a lot, and in the limit that you actually have a really sharp disk on you, you get a reflection off them, and you start getting this bending back of the waves, rays on themselves. And this gives you a triplication. Each discontinuity gives you a triplication in the travel time curve. So you can actually plot the travel time curves if you so desire. And if you just type cfile tim, you get a travel time curve. So this is the curve for those rays that we actually just saw. And if you blow this up again, there it is. Okay, there's this evil little triplication there, and another one right there. And these cause all kinds of problems. There are caustics at the ends of these, and so there are large later arrivals, and you can really get screwed up in this distance range. And I mean, there's a lot of information here, but oftentimes the things that turn in, say, the transition zone of the Earth are actually appearing behind these guys. And so it's very hard to actually get at data which turn, rays which turn in the transition zone of the Earth. We always work on this side, and so we get rays which turn in the top of the lower mantle, all right, and then all the way down to the bottom. But just because of this triplication behavior, it's, and basically every time you try and do this, you know, every SS has its own set of triplications, triple S has its own set of triplications, you end up with this problem. So you'll find that we usually talk about working in the teleseismic distance range, and teleseismic just means beyond what Jeffries called the 20-degree discontinuity, which is, this is about 20 degrees here, which is where all these upper mantle triplicated phases are. Now, the plotting program screwed up here. This is P, but I think it has, there's a low velocity zone in this model. I think there's a low velocity zone in P as well as S. So if you look here at this table, you will find that there is a sudden jump, a little one. Okay, it's more obvious for S. Underscore S. So we have the same thing, triplications. I just want to look at the table. So you can see from 11 degrees, and then the next point here is about 2 degrees, there's a gap. Right, and that gap is caused by the low velocity zone, and that causes a shadow in the travel time curve. Just like the core causes a shadow, so does the low velocity zone. All right, so the message to take away from this is that sharp increases in velocity cause triplications, and velocity decrease causes shadow zones. And all of those happen inside the Earth, of course. Now, the entertaining stuff when it comes when you do the core phases. So this thing, when you say PKP, why don't we just do PKP? it actually doesn't know that there's a convention that PKP might actually go through the inner core. You actually have to tell it that PKPDF is actually PKIKP. I don't know whether you knew that, but that's true. All right, so if you hear people talking about PKPDF, that's the same as the ray that goes all the way around through the middle. This is a mixture of the BC branch, which bottoms just above the core, and the AB branch, which spends a lot of time in the D double prime region right here. So if you look at the travel time curve, the reason they get different names is that there's a triplication again, and, well, there's complexity, in the waveform, so you get something that looks like this. This is the AB branch, and then this is the BC branch, okay? And then the DF branch, the PKIKP, goes up through here if you compute that, but you have to compute that separately. Now, if you enjoy pretty pictures, every time you, so if you look at PKKP, then again, there are two underside reflections. So here, there is an internal caustic. All right, so we're going to get Hilbert transforms again. And also, we're getting triplications because we're seeing both the AB and the BC branches. Now, it turns out that P7KP has actually been observed. So P7KP means that you actually have 7 Ks here. So I think my program will do this. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, P. Why not?
Yay.
Isn't that spectacular? Now, it tells you something about the expected shape of the core mantle, of the core mantle boundary. Because these are 1 hertz P waves that, it takes an array to see them. But it tells you that that is very regular in shape and very sharp. So contrary to what you hear about a lot of ultra-low velocity zones and so on, there's at least to P waves, a lot of the core mantle boundary looks extremely sharp. That's worthwhile bearing that in mind. Okay, look at all those internal caustics. Isn't that great? Okay. All right, so the only other thing I didn't tell you about ray naming is that if you reflect off the top of the core mantle boundary, you get use the symbol little c. If you reflect off the top of the inner core boundary, you use the symbol little I. So run at any pk ikp, and it is case sensitive. You put the big I, you'll get the df in here. And so this is the one that bounces off the inner core boundary. Okay. An underside reflection does not get a symbol. So SS, triple S, whatever. Everybody's clear on that now? You get to play with this afternoon, and you can see if there are certain phases that seem like they should exist, but maybe don't, like SCSP. Actually, that exists, but PCPS doesn't. So, but you can see if you can find something that actually doesn't exist. Okay. All right, so I think that'll do. Now, this code was ray tracing using ray theory, and I'm just going to explain to you how we do that now, because this is how we set up the inversion for doing tomography with ray theory. I think on Thursday that Barbara's going to tell you that there are better ways of doing this, which of course there are. But, any questions on any of that? Oh! One thing I didn't show you, and that is depth phases, and just in case, one more. I think I made a file to do this. Yeah, run path deep. This is, the only difference between this and the others is that this has an earthquake at 400 kilometers in it. So SS 30. Okay, the other one had the earthquake right at the surface, but you can futz with that. Okay, so the little SS gets that symbol because it refers to the waves that go up from the source, hit the surface, and then go on out. And there's a little SS, a little PP, a little SP, all of these things, which you can get conversions at every sharp boundary. I guess I didn't mention that. Every sharp boundary, you can get conversions from S to P. And so you can make up wonderful ray names like SPS or SSP or whatever you want to do. And that's what all these guys are here. Okay, so is that clear? You now understand how every one of these things is sampling the Earth. Good. Well, if you don't, you can play with it. Yes, Sal. All right, can you put something in front of that again? This is a record section of transverse components from an earthquake that I'm very fond of. This is the Bolivian earthquake in 1994. This is in real time. If you align things up on the S wave, then this is what you see. And what you probably are seeing is a bunch of railroad tracks, right? You can see everything comes in pairs. And that's the S phase, and every phase has its little S phase associated with this, because this is a big, deep earthquake, which comes in later, okay? And this difference in time between the S and the little SS is very useful for constraining the depth of the earthquake. Seismology, particularly body wave seismology, is a numbers game. All right, we use travel times to do everything. We have to use the travel times to locate the earthquakes as well as to look at structure. So the more information that we have to help constrain the locations, the better off we are, and these depth phases are useful in that respect. Okay. So let's do some ray theory. This is the Don DePaolo School of Lecturing here. All right. Snell's Law. If you have a ray of light that impinges on a glass block and the refractive indices of 1 is n1 and the refractive index of the block is n2, then the light gets refracted by the law n1 sine theta 1 equals n2 sine theta 2. And in seismology, you just replace the index of refraction by the inverse of the seismic velocity in this layer. And that's okay because the refractive index is just a normalized inverse velocity. It's velocity of light in a vacuum divided by velocity of light in the medium. All right, so what's important here is that as you go along this ray, 1 upon v sine theta, 1 upon v sine theta, 1 upon v sine theta always stays the same. Okay? So we give that 1 upon v sine theta, the symbol p, the ray parameter. Eventually you'll hit a turning point where theta is 90 degrees, so p is just the inverse of the velocity right at the turning point. So it's actually nice to be able to measure p, and this is a little demonstration that p, the ray parameter, is if you have a bunch of stations on the surface of the Earth and you see a wavefront go past you and you measure the time it takes to go from here, this station, to this station, and you know the distance between them, then this little proof just shows that the ray parameter is just dt/dx. So it's the slope of the travel time curve. All right? So travel time curves are typically curved, and if you measure the slope of it, then you get the ray parameter for that ray that's arriving at that particular point on the travel time curve. And every point has a slightly different slope because it has a different ray coming to it. Okay, now the Earth, unfortunately, isn't flat. So we have to do something a little bit more complicated. And the only real complication is geometric, in that on a spherical Earth, this angle here is not the same as this angle here because the radius vector has changed. Okay? So one over v sine theta doesn't stay constant because theta isn't the same here and here as it was in the flat case. All right? So you have to do a little bit of algebra here, and you find that r1 sine theta 2 is equal to r2 sine theta 2 prime. Okay, just from looking at this little triangle here and this triangle here. And that means that r sine theta is the thing you have to use rather than sine theta. So p now is just equal to r over v, where r is radius, times sine theta. And theta is always the angle the ray makes with, in this case, the radius vector. And in spherical Earths, you actually use different units now. P is usually measured in seconds per radian or seconds per degree. On a flat Earth, it's actually measured in seconds per kilometer. And so this P on the spherical Earth is just dt/del, where del is measured in either radians or degrees. Okay? All right, so the ray parameter is key. It's the thing that stays constant along a ray, and it's what we use to say, I want to look at this particular ray. And I just choose the ray parameter, and that specifies a particular ray. I know I'm going to... Okay. A little bit of algebra. This is really very straightforward. Here's a ray. You do the usual thing. You look at a little segment of the ray here. And so we're going from xi equals 0 to xi equals del. And we look at this little segment, which subtends an angle dxi. So there's a little triangle right there. Here it is. Okay. Theta is the angle that the ray makes with the radius vector. I'm going to say this little arc length of the ray is d gamma long. And so this is r dxi, and this is dr. Right? Anybody see that? Okay. You can do a little bit of math over here. So we can get rid of sine theta. Okay, so sine theta is just r dxi by d gamma. And so you can get rid of sine theta using the expression for the ray parameter, p equals r over v sine theta. And you find that d gamma is equal to this. Okay, and this is going to be used later on. All right, now, in ray theory, a travel time is just the integral along the ray of 1 upon v, d gamma. So this is an integral actually right along this ray. And if you perturb this thing to get a perturbation in travel time, which is what we're measuring, you just differentiate this thing and you get a minus delta v over v squared in here. And if you're quick, you will realize that isn't really the whole story, right? Because if I change the velocity, I'm going to change the ray path. Okay, so it's not really kosher to just use the same rate path as I did before. But fortunately, there was this guy called Fermat who tells us that the travel time is stationary to small perturbations in the rate path. Okay, and that's a really nice variational principle that's good to remember. But it also means that the small change in the rate path that we get by changing the structure can be ignored as far as the rate path is concerned, and we're allowed to use the original rate path. Okay? So even though it's wrong, it's right. Okay, now typically what we do in 3D seismology, when we're thinking about tomography, is we will convert this integral over the ray path to an integral over distance around here. And to do that, what we need is this thing here. Okay, so we just look in here, and I want to convert this d gamma here to a dxi. So my g of xi has to look like this. Whoa. All right. Just to make this change of variables from here to here. And I have an expression for d gamma by dxi up here. All right. So my kernel in here, when I use this expression here, is just minus r squared over pv cubed. Okay, now, that r and v is the location on the ray as I go along in distance, right? So r and v, even though this is in terms of the arc distance along here, I have to be able to track what the r is as I go along so I can evaluate this kernel. Is that clear? All right, so even though this is a very simple looking kernel, I still have to do a little bit more math to be able to compute it. And to do that, you go back to this thing and you say, well, tan theta is just r dxi by dr, because I need to know how r changes as xi changes as I go around. And so you just use some elementary algebra and you come up with this answer here. So this tells me that now if... thank you. Okay, so as I go along the ray, all right, what I can do is as I go along in xi, I can compute what r is using this equation. All right? Well, that's not much help anyway. But. All right. So using this equation, I can compute, as I go step along in distance, I can use this equation to compute what dr is, all right, how much I go down in depth. So I can then find out what the velocity is at that radius, and I can evaluate this kernel as for that particular distance. I just move along in distance, and I'm implicitly going along inside the Earth as I do that and computing this kernel. And if I'm doing block kind of tomography, as I go along inside the Earth, I just keep track of which blocks I'm going through. And so there's a block. Okay. And I'll say, okay, as I step along in distance, I'm now in block 3,964, and you keep track of what the kernel is in that block, and then you go into the next block. And then you just integrate that vector that you have of kernel versus block versus distance, all right? And you have everything you need to be able to do a tomographic inversion. So it's really that straightforward, okay? All it took was Snell's law and a little bit of geometry. You can use this equation to get the 1D result if you just integrate this thing from over depth from zero to the turning point of the ray, or from the turning point to the surface, because we're doing spherical Earth stuff, then you would get half the distance that the ray would travel, right? And because you would go from, if I integrate from here to here, then I would get this distance from here to here, and I'd have to multiply that by 2 to get the bit back up here. All right, so if I take that equation here and I just integrate it, multiply by 2, integrate from the turning point, then I get an expression for the distance, and this is what I would use in a spherical Earth problem. So now I don't have to worry about velocity changing laterally. Velocity just changes as a function of radius, and so I can compute distance. And there's a little bit of futzing here to get an expression for t, and it's the same kind of thing. But it's very straightforward. So now, you choose ray parameter, and now you can compute t and del. All right, and that's how you make up a travel time curve. you choose ray parameter, compute T and del, choose another ray parameter, compute T and del, and then finally you make up a nice travel time curve. Okay, but it's, you don't choose del and compute T, right? You choose rays using the ray parameter. People get nervous about these equations because if you remember that P is R over V sine theta, and at the turning point of the ray, theta is 90 degrees. So P is just equal to R over V. And when you get this kind of thing happening with a 1 over a square root, then of course the integrand here is going to blow up, all right, which isn't very pleasant. But this is just a square root singularity. All right, it's basically integrating 1 over t to the 1 half, all right? And it doesn't matter, I mean, if you integrate that, you get a half t to the half, right? And it doesn't matter that t goes to 0, the integral still exists, okay? So the integral's fine, it's just that the integrand itself goes to 0. But this does tell you that the sensitivity of a travel time will probably be peaked close to the turning point, because these kernels get big down there. So this is why we often, if we measure travel time residuals, we'll often group the residuals by the turning depths of the rays and try and get a picture of what we think those particular rays are seeing, because we believe that the rays are dominantly sensitive to structure close to the turning points just because of this kind of behavior. All right? It may not actually be true, right? But I'm trying to give a heuristic reason for why we plot things at the turning point. Yeah. All right, okay. Now, I have to tell you a little bit. You'll often hear the expression long period body wave and short period body wave. And this is historical in many ways. Maybe I can, is that thing still alive? And the reason is that the Earth has a large source of noise. Oh no, I lost my glasses. Oh, here they are. Well, you know. Good grief. Where am I? I'm in a senior moment here. Okay. All right, let's just look at one of these. These are files for particular events, and they're actually of data that's sampled once every second, so they're not really broadband data, but they're broadband enough for what I'm going to show you. Curse is the name of my time series editor, which is well named. Okay, so this is what raw data looks like often. Yeah. This is three components, and somewhere this is a station in the western U.S. Somewhere in there is a seismic wave, but if you just look at this stuff, it turns out that this fuzz here is dominant period 6 seconds or so, and that fuzz is caused by non-interactions of ocean waves causing pressure variations on the ocean floor. And basically, it's everywhere. All right, you can be in the middle of a continent, and you have this six-second buzz going on. Actually, there's another mode which is 12 or 13 seconds too. And so there's this big band of noise, right? And it's basically everywhere. Now, in the good old days, when people did analog recording, they didn't have the dynamic range to deal with all this stuff. So what they did was they designed systems which would either work on the high frequency end of the microseismic band, typically centered on a period of about a second, or on the low frequency side of the microseismic band, typically going from 15 seconds on down. And so that's why we have long period stuff and short period stuff. Okay, now these days, the systems can record these guys, and you can filter these things and see all of the little seismic signals on top of them, and everything's fine. If you look at the raw data, it looks like shit still, right? But it's the high frequency. It's the dominant thing that you see here. All of this. If you count, You can't see. Let me get rid of my duck. No, I'm not going to do that. Could be a mistake. Yeah. Yeah, you can count numbers here. I can't read it because I have my glasses on. But this is about, it's about a 6 second period. All right. So there are, in practice, you really still do have to work on either side of this mass, except for the big earthquakes, which are big enough to overwhelm it. There's a whole cottage industry of working with short period waves, and typically when we talk about ISC data set, International Seismological Commission, we're talking about short period stuff. And then there are people like me who work on the long period side, periods of 15 seconds and longer. And there are advantages and disadvantages to both. Okay, if you work with short period data, then you're intrinsically working with shorter wavelength stuff. Okay, seismic velocity is typically 10 kilometers per second. So if you have a period of a second, you're talking about something with a wavelength of 10 kilometers, right? And you can really do high resolution stuff. Okay, if you're talking about something with 20 second period, then you're talking about something with a 200 kilometer wavelength. Okay, and so intrinsically there is less resolution. So if you want to do some regional tomography on slabs, something like that, then you better use short period data. Okay, most of the Earth, we actually don't have the coverage to be able to see things on a 10 kilometer resolution. So it's not necessarily a bad thing that your data have an intrinsic smoothing to them on the order of a few hundred kilometers. Okay, so I don't feel too bad about using long period data. And it does have some advantages. And the advantages are is that at 1 second, the crust is very scatters like fury. Okay, so every time a wave comes in, the seismic energy gets scattered, and you see this whole what we call a coder of energy coming in after the first arrival, and it can obscure second arrivals. I think Adam showed a picture of an extreme case, the moon, right? But it also happens on the Earth too. Now, if you go to 15 or 20 seconds, all of that disappears. All right, the crust does not scatter on those kinds of wavelengths anymore. And so if you want to pick later arrivals, like an SS or an SES or something like that, then the long period data are much better to use. Okay, so to be able to do all this stuff, then, well, it'd be nice to use both, of course.
Since this ocean signal seems to be the dominant signal when you first look at your raw data, is this like a signal that you can subtract globally at any station, or are there some ocean models that you require to take this?
Oh, no, it's... people use microseisms now to track. You can use them to track storms. they're basically little Rayleigh waves, little surface waves. That's dominantly what this stuff is, and it's very directional. But it changes, and it will change abruptly. And it's really an interesting beast. If you look at stations in Southern California around us, then the arrival of the microseisms is almost always from one particular direction, but then if you get a big storm in Alaska, it'll suddenly change and come in from there, or even from the East Coast, you know, some big storm comes in, and we have some records of the perfect storm, right?
Wouldn't these be then subject to the same kind of things, aren't they sensitive to the crustal structure?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, they're... I don't think anybody's using them to do structural studies because. Oh, really? Okay. Yeah.
And it's not a very good point source.
No, it's not. It's not a good point source, so you don't know where the source is. But you can measure probably dispersion effects from. Yeah. Yeah. But we regard it as noise rather than a signal. But you know, one man's noise, as they say. Oh no, what we do is we just filter the hell out of it. So we just get rid of it either on the high frequency end or on the short frequency end. So it's gone. I hope it's gone anyway. All right. No, it's not something we try and model.
It's not always the biggest
thing. No, it's okay. But I'm trying to explain historically why we have long and short period data. All right. Okay, so can you do that thing again? So if you actually look at stacks of real data, Where was my travel time curve? Then, well, you can remember what all these different phases are, right? I see, I don't think this is the same scale. Oh, maybe it is. How about that? Okay. So all of these funky lines that you see in here, you don't actually measure. So this is actually a stack of real data, and so whenever you see high amplitude stuff, there is a chance of actually measuring these things. And so you can see things like P, this is diffracted P around the core mantle boundary, which actually my program won't do, so you can't ask P diff, I'm afraid. But sorry about that. Here are the core phases, this is PP, this is PCP. And then there's some exotic phases back here, which are funky things. There's, boy, I don't even know what that is. Maybe it's a different scale. No, it's not a different scale. I thought that was PKKS, but I guess it isn't. Oh, that's true. Yeah, I suppose we could use the right graph, but that would be cheating. Of course, they should be the same. It's just what this tells you is that different phases appear in different frequency bands, right? So if you really, really want to look at something like these exotic core phases here, then short period data works, and it's not so good in the long period data. Okay, so this is so these are good candidates for investigation using short period data. If you look at the long period vertical. The dripping?
You heard about the
drip? Well, you see, these are stacks. So what you do is you bin the seismograms by distance and time range, and then just add them all together. Hopefully, you equalize the phase. So if there's an arrival letter, I'm pointing in the right direction. All right, so it doesn't matter, you do this whether or not you think there's a phase there or not, including before the P. So this is like a measure of background noise. So the only stuff that you should believe is when you see the black lines in here, right? That's something coming out of the background noise, because every one of these is a little pixel that you just average all the seismograms in. And if there's a coherent arrival in there, then it will stand out. Right? You're just trying to find out what arrivals are in there. So well, that's because Peter cheated and did some gain stacking. I mean, so it's to suppress the coda, right? There's some tricks in the stacking so that you don't just see coda of one phase and it completely blacks out everything else, all right?
So.
Which lines? These lines? The programs on the computer. So this is from a model. Okay.
Tell me a little bit more about this. Is the overlay diagram that we're looking at, is that a reference
group? This is IASP 91 model, but it really doesn't matter which one you use. To within a few seconds, you will predict these things correctly.
Okay, right. So, but it's a reference to a model.
It's a 1D model, right.
Okay.
No. This is the whole of the global network, short period verticals, and for every, I think they're probably shallow earthquakes. Yeah, I'm sure they're shallow earthquakes. And then you say, okay, I have a distance of 20 degrees, and a distance of 90 degrees, and I'm going to look at a time of 20 minutes into the seismogram from the earthquake source. And you just take every seismogram and you stack them all together. You can do an envelope stack, or you can.
This is a confirmation of the geometry gradient structure of the
Earth. Oh, sure. I mean, travel time. A large travel time anomaly for a P wave is a few seconds. Right. A large travel time anomaly. Okay. So a second is typical for 3D structure. Okay. So the scale here is minutes. All right. So you can't.
Yeah.
Well, you can't see it here, but what this tells you is what are the dominant phases in the actual seismogram. So this is a key to help you go and look and say, okay, does it make sense to look at SCP on verticals? And the answer is probably, well, maybe actually, this might be SCP. This is short period data. So this is on the high frequency side. The long period. Yeah. Okay. Now, on this one, you see many more things. So I suppose I better get the right overlay here. So this is the vertical. All right, so here's the P wave, diffracted P. Now, because you're looking at longer periods, you can actually see the diffraction go a lot further around the core. So it goes a long way. The core shadow starts about 98 degrees, and so you can see that you can see it diffracting around the core. Everybody happy with what I mean by diffraction? All right, yeah. Yeah. It might be. Yeah, let me try this one. Okay, so here's the core. Normally, you would have a shadow for P like that, and this would be about 98 degrees. But because you get diffraction around here, right? So, and it can go quite a ways, 160, 170 degrees. These are the core phases. This is PP. This is, and then this is the S, first arriving S wave. Okay. This is S, and then you can see some phases coming in here. These are called SKS, so these are core phases, and they actually cross S at about 80 degrees. And on a vertical component instrument, that's an important thing because it means that there are other phases interfering with the first arriving S here you have to worry about. And that's a problem. It's a real problem with the ISC data. These guys are SP, and then you get multiple S. You know, this is double S, triple S, and then finally you come out with the surface wave back here. All right? So all of these are fair game, and you can see they wrap around. So PP comes back, this is maybe triple P, comes back like that. I have the index here, we can figure out what everything is. Okay, so yeah, that's triple P, goes back. Okay, so you can compute all of these things. Now, remember what that looks like. Okay, and then this is the transverse component. Okay, and it's a lot simpler. And the reason is we've basically gotten rid of everything with a P leg in it. Okay? But you can see the P wave is still here. It's not supposed to be, but it is. And the reasons for that are, well, possibly anisotropy 3D structure, but also it's the fact that the instruments aren't known perfectly too, so you get some residual. Here's S. This is SCS, double S, triple S, quadruple S. And so on, all the way up until hit the love wave. All right?
Is the reason for not seeing anything beyond the surface waves, is it because you're getting that?
Well, it's probably a stacking thing. Of course, you do see phases further around. If you plot this thing up for a lot greater time, you can see the surface wave wrapping around like this, and but so do all the body wave packets. Adam showed something called the X phase. All right, but if you look at the X phase, it's really just these all of these body waves wrapping around and appearing in between the surface waves. Okay, so yeah. This is SCS here. Here's the core shadow, and then this is diffracted S. And transverse component.
There is a sort of a faint line.
With this one? Oh, that's SCS, SCS. This one? That's the double bounce SCS, SCS coming back. So that's the equivalent to SS, but something that hits the core twice. Okay. I'm not sure I know what this is. I don't think it's supposed to be there. Oh well, it's probably SP or something like that, sneaking in. Okay, how are we doing here? Yikes. All right, now this is what gets reported to the ISC. All right, so now these are individual picks. And what the ISC does is that it sits in England, and people send their particular picks just say, travel time I measured was X, and off it goes to the ISC, and they're supposed to collate all that stuff, and they relocate earthquakes. Actually, that's what their major function is, and then they provide all those picks to the community. And so this, it's an arrival time. All right, so you see a wiggle here, and somebody will pick. I think that this thing arrived at this time. All right, and we're going to do some picking in a minute, but. And typically, on the ISC data, you're looking at short period verticals predominantly, and so they're quite impulsive, and it's the first break that people will try and pick as the arrival time of that pulse. This is not so good for later phases, but for the first arriving P, this is fine, and the first arriving P data set is extremely precise and a very useful data set. Some of it's a little... too precise. There's this 1 minute phase that comes in before the P wave, and that's an historical artifact of when we had drum recording, and you had to count from the, you got this piece of paper here with the lines on, and you had to count how many lines down the drum recording to figure out which minute you were on, and people would screw up and they'd get the wrong minute, and so there's a minute phase before, and actually there's a minute phase afterwards as well that you can see there. But fortunately, a minute is a big signal as far as P waves are concerned, so you can identify that and get rid of it. So this is a big data set, and there are probably 8 or 9 million P wave arrivals, first arriving P waves, that you can use to do tomography. It's a very redundant data set, all right, because the coverage is really dictated by the sources and the receivers, and so it has all of the same characteristic holes in coverage that most other data sets do too. Even though they have a lot of data, it's basically repeat measurements of most things. So you can see, absolutely.
So the fuzz on these lines is better than that.
Some of it is due to the fact that everything's binned here for events shallower than 50 kilometers, and so the arrival time will change between a 0 kilometer earthquake and a 50 kilometer earthquake. So you'll get a little range in here just because you're not just looking at only very shallow earthquakes. But I can tell you from my experience is that some operators will pick everything that they think is possibly an arrival. All right, so you'll get a P and then you'll get another pick and then another pick and then another pick, and who knows what they are. All right, but they're all plotted on here. So you can't always associate operator picks with a sensible arrival.
The nice thing about the ISC data set is that over the period of 40 years, there have been something like 6,000 different stations reported. So in a way, even though there's noise in the data, you get actually better coverage at this short period than you would with, say, global digital stations.
Yeah, and if the stations tend to be clustered in various places, so if you want to do detailed tomography of Japan, whatever, then this is the kind of data set that you should use. Right? But I still think it's true that we have the ocean problem with these data as much as we do with the long period data. Okay. P is the thing that's most often picked. There's only very few stations actually pick later arrival. So the ISC data set for S is a lot smaller than it is for P, and it's usually only certain stations that actually pick it. Usually the observatory better stations. But you can see there's minute phases on the core phases here too. All right. It's usually the confidence is whether or not the arrival was impulsive or emergent. All right. So oftentimes these things can just appear out of the noise, and you're not really sure where it started. But if you, even if you restrict yourself to only measurements that are impulsive, that you expect would be good to about a tenth of a second, then you still have millions of data to play with. Okay. All right, so this is, I've got to be careful with Adam here. I don't say anything bad about the ISC. But, this is one of the problems with the ISC, is that they have algorithms for identifying phases that aren't necessarily accurate. This is what happens if you look at S arrivals, but now I've flattened the travel time curve, so it's just flat. So I'm taking a reducing time out. And everything that the ISC thinks is an S wave has been pulled out of here. So what's left, you see, is this line here and this line here. Of course, this is the SKS, all right? And that's crossing, because the S phases are also picked from short period verticals, we think. It's never always clear where they're actually picked from. And so in this distance range, you're really going to have a problem with the SKS crossing and interfering with you. And here's PCS, you can see going across there. But the important point is that the ISC has an algorithm that says everything that comes so close to the JB tables, plus or minus 7 seconds, I think it is an S wave, all right? And of course, S anomalies can be huge, right? Plus or minus 15 seconds would be a much better window, all right? So the bottom line is you cannot necessarily use the ISC identifications of the phases, right? You have to go back to the raw picks, which are still in the catalog there, and then re-identify them as being S yourself, and then you'll get the true distribution. Okay?
Well, actually, in ISC bulletins, they give both their identification of the phase and the operator.
Uh-huh.
This what was sent to them,
uh-huh.
And you can always fall back on the operator.
Yeah.
Because they don't window that way.
But I think it's fair to say that anybody who does this would re-identify the picks themselves, right? They would, and to make sure that everything was right. But this business with SKS is a problem, because it means that all of this stuff out here is uncertain, and it means that you cannot really image the lowermost part of the mantle in S using the ISC dataset. Right? People have tried to do this, but I don't think it's a terribly successful way of doing it. Okay, this is just this is ray density for ISC, and this is just a measure of how much, if you divide the Earth into blocks, how many rays go through a block. All right, so for P waves down at the base of the mantle, you can just see that for S waves, the number is not very big, and it's because of this problem with SKS and so on. But by and large, it's always a lot smaller. And the scale is even smaller by order of magnitude 2 than the P waves. And I'll show some more of this with the long period data in a minute. Okay, now with long period data, picking first breaks is not a good idea. So we have to do something else. And so what I do is I used to pick by making a little synthetic. And the synthetic for me is an impulse response of the instrument broadened with an attenuation operator. Okay, now, attenuation operator, this is what we call a T-star operator, and it's a high-frequency approximation to what attenuation does to body waves. so if you have an absorption band here, where this is frequency, and you have some attenuation over a large frequency range, then within that frequency range, here you will get what's called physical dispersion. The velocity will be a function of frequency, and in the high frequency limit you get the unrelaxed velocity, and at the low frequency limit you get the relaxed velocity. But so two things are going to happen when you have attenuation. This change in velocity as a function of frequency will give you a time shift as a function of frequency, so the waves will be dispersed, okay, and we call this kind of dispersion physical dispersion. All right. And then there will be an attenuation term. And so the operators that you end up convolving with look like this. All right. Well, this is actually the impulse response of the instrument convolved with a T-star operator. And so the waves get broadened, and you cut out high frequencies effectively. That's what attenuation will do. And it will get reduced in amplitude. Okay, and so it's a filtering operation that we do to mimic the effect of attenuation. All right, so let's do some picks. Okay, this is what you have to do, preferably 500,000 of this afternoon. All right, so. Yeah, I don't want this on. I'm having another senior moment here, it's all right. Okay, so what do I want to do here? Okay, this first earthquake's pretty small, so let's go to a different one. All right, so what I did here was to filter this data. So I'm looking at 20 seconds longer period, 15 seconds longer period. So now I'm on the short, on the long period side of the microseismic band. And what I'm looking for is something that looks like a P wave. So this thing here, this is not a very big earthquake, so but we'll do it anyway. All right, so here's my little T-star broadened impulse response, which I can move around, all right? And each click is 2/10 of a second. So, you know, that's okay. Ooh, that's nasty. All right, so here's a better one, all right? So. Yeah. All right, so you just do this 100,000 times, and yeah. Actually you do it about 1,000,000 times to get 100,000 data. But so that's really boring, right? Really boring. But you know, people try and do this automatically, and I think you get out what you put in, basically. So because oftentimes, well, you have to throw away a lot of data when you do this automatically in quality control checks. So you end up with less data, even though it takes you a lot less time. Now, this is tedious, and it turns out that there are better ways of doing it. This is kind of the digital version of what the ISC operator is doing, right? He's looking in and saying, I'm going to pick that point right there, which wouldn't necessarily be a good thing on a long period of wave, because you can't really see where it's coming out of the background. So having this little bit of a wiggle here to help you is good. All right, let's see if there's another one here. So. All right.
So is there
some kind of a output so you can see how long you're doing? Or do you have a... It's purely eyeball. Yeah, but, you know, come on. It's pretty obvious where it is, isn't it?
What's the scale? The horizontal scale?
Every click is 2/10 of a second. that's a sample point. 5 clicks is a sample point. You can do it fast, but it's really, really, really boring. What?
They want to know how accurate.
Well, I mean, for something like this, you can pick it to 2/10 of a second, right? Which is why I chose 2/10 of a second. All right. So, and a P wave anomaly can be 3 or 4 seconds. An S wave anomaly can be 15 seconds. So, you know, the picking error is not really the problem here. What is the problem is that there's so much data now that this is impractical to do it this way. Right? For every event, I have maybe 250 records to look at. And you know, I'm looking at an event per day, typically. So it would take me a day to do a month of data, even with the minimum number of coffee breaks that would be required to do that. So I'm, you know, I'm working at 30:1 real time here. And if I want to do P and S and SS and so on, pretty soon I'm working behind real time, right? So this is not an option. All right, so what we do things a little.
Guys, so what would you record as the parallel time? Where first starts to go off, or the first maximum, or what?
Well, I always, because I'm using this very simple synthetic, I always concentrate on this first break here. Because this has got, this will have other things in it. Oh, sorry. I concentrate on the first break here and ignore what's going on here, because this has depth phases and all other kinds of crap coming in. All I'm really interested in is what's going on at the front there. And what is recorded is where I put the impulse response in the synthetic. All right? And then it's filtered and smeared out and delayed by the instrument response and by the T-star operator, and then that's what I fit. But what is recorded is the time that I put the delta function into all that filtering. And so if my if my T-star operator were correct, the time that I would be predicting here would be the unrelaxed time. It would be as if the Earth were purely elastic, you know, because I've corrected for everything else. Okay, so let's not do that anymore, because that's kind of tedious. Where am I? Oops. So this is what we do now, I think. Famous last words. Ooh, it's not a very good earthquake. Let's do All right, so these are all the P waves for a particular earthquake, all right? And they're just arranged by distance. And what I finally realized was that the waveforms for a P wave for a particular event are all very similar to one another. They change from event to event because the source impacts the character to the waveforms, which is important later on. So what we can do is we can cross-correlate every waveform with every other waveform, all right? And then we can group them hierarchically by groups of waveforms which are similar to one another. All right? And it's a cluster. For earthquakes of magnitude 5.5 and bigger, the pulse shape has a lot of the source in it. Yep. It solves for polarities in two as well. And now, when I did that, it now thinks that there are basically two groups of waves here. There's this group here, and then there's the top group, and it thinks that those guys are subtly different. And I can, by choosing the vertical cursor here, I can cut this mass into smaller and smaller subgroups of more and more similar waveforms. All right. So if I cut here, I would just cut into two groups. If I cut here, I'd have a little group in the middle there that I would lose, which I probably want to because it looks a bit bad. So if I click now, then I'll get the first cluster here, which I can now measure the relative arrival times for, and then I can measure the relative arrival times in that cluster. Okay, and they're good to about a tenth of a second, the relative arrival times, because now you're measuring things to things that are very similar to one another rather than to a synthetic. Okay, so I've just measured a whole earthquake in the same time it took me to do one pick before, which is makes me feel good. All right. It makes my students feel even better. So that's how we do it right now, and then we actually make a master trace. In every cluster, we just shift and sum the traces, have one trace, and then measure the absolute arrival time of that. And then you've got differential times between all the traces, and now you have absolute times for everything. Right, so now you can move along pretty quickly. And this works really well. Every time you have a phase that exists over a large distance range. Okay, so you can do it for double S and triple S and all these other things too. Okay, now one other thing I did want to show. Wow, it's coffee time. Okay. Oops. You do a lot of this when you're looking for differential phase. Ah! Yes! Okay. All right, so here's this is Albuquerque. Good Albuquerque. All right, so this earthquake, here's S, and here is double S. All right, now, if you remember from early on in the lecture, if I want to measure the differential time between these two, then I have to Hilbert transform this guy, right, because of that internal caustic. And I also have to, because S only goes through the upper mantle twice, almost all the attenuation inside the Earth occurs in a very thin layer near the surface in the asthenosphere. All right, so every time a ray goes through that layer, it gets nailed. Okay, the only other place that really happens is the inner core, and it's kind of weird, but. So SS, because it hits and goes through, it has twice as many legs going through that. So it's attenuated roughly twice as much as this is. So I have to apply a little T-star operator to the S, this guy here, as well as the Hilbert transform. So I click here, and I screw up. So you just measure SS minus S. And if you're smart, you'll make the polarity, relative polarity of these guys here be 1, which means that you're forcing the S and the SS and the S to have the same polarity coming out of the source. And that's almost always true because they have very similar takeoff angles out of the source. Okay, so you can measure these things. They're not as precise as the absolute times because the waveforms are quite distorted in many ways. But, you know, you can see that's good to a couple of tenths of a second, right? And we have maybe 30 or 40,000 of these. Now, you can only do this in the distance range about 48 degrees, so you get past the triplications for SS. All right, the triplications for S occur about 20 degrees. So for SS, they actually occur about 40 degrees. For triple S, they occur at 60 degrees and so on. So you have to start beyond the triplicated range, and you can only do this for as long as you have S to refer to, which is 100 degrees. So you can do this for distance ranges between about 48, 50 degrees and 100 degrees. So there's a limited number of distance ranges you can do it on, but it's fine. See, that's Bill. This is in Siberia. Okay? So, easy, okay? And so these are nice, differential times are nice because they care less about the source. One of the biggest problems we have, which I was going to talk about, maybe I'm not, is the location of the source. And there's a big trade-off between the depth of the earthquake and the origin time. And the reason is that travel time curves for deep earthquakes are basically offset from travel time curves for shallow earthquakes. You cannot tell the difference between that offset travel time curve and a change in the origin time unless you have stations close to the source, above the source, and then you can make the distinction. Okay. Or if you have depth phases, okay, they're golden because then you can get the depth of the earthquake. so there'll be 4 or 5 second shifts in origin time. Maybe I have. How much time do I have? Well, I was planning to stop at 10:15 because that's coffee time. All right. You guys aren't having any fun, are you? Okay, I'll talk about this next time. And there's a section in your notes on the importance of earthquake location. It turns out that source effects in travel times, either just because of the finite size of the source. If you have a source that goes on for a few seconds, then effectively the time that you will measure will depend upon the frequency content of the wave that you have. A short period wave will see the onset of rupture. A longer period wave will see somewhere into the rupture. And you'll get a shift back in time depending on the source size. Now, obviously, that's bad, right? Because you want to know about structure. You don't want to know about the source. Well, some people do. So that's an issue, and then earthquake location is an issue because we only know where earthquakes are to only order of 15 kilometers, and that translates to about a second in P wave arrival time, which is almost the same as the signal from 3D structure. Okay, so you cannot screw around with the source. You have to deal with it explicitly, and there's things in the notes which say that. This is just to indicate the kind of variations that you get. This is comparing ISC locations and NEIC, the National Earthquake Institute Information Center, something like what it was called. So this compares delta X and delta Y if you just think of a local Cartesian coordinate system right at the source. And so these things are not correlated with each other, but delta Z, the error in depth, and the origin time of the earthquake are one-to-one correlated, and it's because of this fact that deep earthquakes have travel time curves which are parallel to those of shallow earthquakes, so there's this big trade-off between the two. And this is big, right? It's 4 seconds, right? So if you don't take care of this, you're immediately imparting some random 4-second signal into your data that you're going to have to deal with somehow, right? So there's a discussion in the notes on how to deal with that. And this is really the major complication in doing travel time tomography, is the source, both the source finiteness effect and the mislocation effect. And of course, those two are kind of the same thing, because you don't know what you really mean by the location of an earthquake when you're looking at long period waves. Is it the middle of the rupture? You know, it becomes a more fuzzy thing. But you have to deal with it, and the notes tell you how to do that. So I guess I'll stop, and then next time we'll talk about inverting. Next Friday we'll talk about inverting this stuff for structure. Okay?